Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Can a neutrally worded status update statement from Lausanne, Switzerland be seen as progress, diplomatic trouble, or the prelude to a historic deal on the Iranian nuclear program? See if you can judge. Here's today's joint statement, read first by Vice President of the European Commission and Italian official Federica Mogherini, speaking in Lausanne, Switzerland.
Today, we have taken a decisive step. We have reached solutions on key parameters of a joint comprehensive plan of action.
Solutions on key parameters, but more work and a final agreement by June. Graduate students use language like that to stall handing in their PhD dissertations, but these senior diplomats, many with doctorates, officials from the U.S., Iran, and five other nations, say that momentum is underway to get to a final deal to limit Iran's nuclear program, possibly lift sanctions, and create a path towards normalized Iranian relations with the rest of the world.
Today, the United States, together with our allies and partners, has reached a historic understanding with Iran, which, if fully implemented, will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon. As President and Commander-in-Chief, I have no greater responsibility than the security of the American people. And I am convinced that if this framework leads to a final comprehensive deal, it will make our country, our allies, and our world safer.
President Obama commenting on the talks earlier today. Some details from the negotiations include new cooperation between the U.S. and Iran on technology sharing. Iranian sources are saying a firm agreement on Iran keeping 6,000 uranium centrifuges is part of this preliminary framework. Former U.S. Ambassador Dennis Ross, a longtime Middle East peace negotiator and President Obama's special assistant on Iran from 2009 to 2011, says no one should underestimate the amount of diplomatic effort this all represents.
We've seen the difficulty of even reaching this, which is still at some level of generality. The idea of having a finely tuned agreement with great technical detail done by June 30th suggests to me that if this has been difficult, that will truly be an ordeal. So I think that's what we're facing right now. And then the question is, gets to the heart of what are the real issues that are out there. And we are, I think, also going to find that the scope of verification is also going to be a very hard nut to crack, maybe not at this stage, but before you close the deal itself.
According to unclassified or leaked documents from the Johnson administration and later, the U.S. was largely responsible for Pakistan getting a bomb and that technology ending up then in the hands of Iran. Do we trust Pakistan with a nuclear bomb any more than we trust or distrust Iran with a nuclear capacity of any capability at all?
And part of the problem is that obviously Pakistan's been a nuclear weapon state for a long time now.
Yeah.
We suspended assistance to Pakistan for a long time because of what they did. I think there's a lot of concern at one level about Pakistan, but it's a reality. Pakistan and India are kind of locked in a regional rivalry. Iran, we look at differently. We have a history with Iran that is very different. The hostages, you know, are still – there's still a bare legacy here. We lost 243 soldiers to Hezbollah in Beirut, armed, backed, trained, an extension of the Iranian. So there's a deep history here with Iran. And also, Iran, as a member of the NPT, violated its understandings. It was supposed to reveal all its nuclear-related activities and didn't do that. So there's a history here that obviously raises questions for us as it relates to Iran. And also, Iran affects all of its neighbors. I mean, the Saudis and others, I can tell you from conversations I had with the King of Saudi Arabia in 2009 when I was in the administration, when I was dealing with him and I was trying to explain what we're doing with Iran, he simply said to me, if they get it, we get it.
We'll get to that in a moment. Violators of NPT, Iranians and others would say that the Israelis are violators of NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There are other violators of the Non-Proliferation Treaty that the U.S. seems to tolerate. Iran is different.
Well, Israel's not a member of the NPT. So hard to violate something you're
right.
not a member
well,
of.
I mean, that's even worse, arguably.
Well, the Iranians signed up to it, though, and then they are supposed to reveal all their nuclear-related activities. They never revealed their enrichment activities. what was done at Natanz and at Fordo was revealed, you know, not by them, by us and by others. So there's a history here of them, in a sense, undertaking obligations, but not necessarily being bound by the obligations.
Let's look regionally. Perhaps the best argument against this deal with Iran is that it would start a nuclear arms race in the Middle East with the Saudis wanting to be a nuclear power alongside the Iranians. Do you think that is the case?
Well, as I said, I mean, I had this conversation with the King of Saudi Arabia in May of 2009, where I sort of laid out what we were doing, why we were doing it, and he was not interested in any of the explanations. He simply wanted to say, if they get it, we get it.
Turki Al-Faisal, the former intelligence chief, has said this to the BBC within the last 3 weeks.
That's right. And I would even say it's something very interesting that people didn't really pick up. The Saudis had their national day, and on the national day they paraded Chinese-made missiles. And they had the chief of staff of the Pakistani military there to review, and they were reviewing parade. And it's clear that wasn't a signal for us. That was a signal to the Iranians that we have a capability. The missiles could carry a nuclear bomb, and it's clear that this was a signal to them. We're seeing a Saudi-Iranian rivalry played out in terms of two proxy wars right now in Syria and in Yemen. So I think we'd have to take it pretty seriously that if the Saudis say they would do this, for those who say they wouldn't, I'm not one of those who share a kind of calm about that. I think, in fact, they would do it.
Some would say that it's naive to suggest that the U.S. and Iran are somehow at odds in Syria when, in fact, they're working together to fight ISIS in Syria on some level, and that in fact the U.S. and Iran have more in common right now in terms of regional politics than they ever have had before, which is an argument for bringing normalized relations to the front burner here. What would you say to that?
Well, I guess I would say the following. I mean, I think we have a convergence of interests. You know, there's an old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, although I've often found the Middle East, the enemy of my enemy still ends up being your enemy. You know, when the Supreme Leader gives his Nowruz message and there are chants death to America, it's clear there's an ideological basis to the regime that is founded on hostility towards us. There's a paradox because the Iranian public isn't hostile to us. We probably have, if you were to survey most of the countries of the Middle East and if there was an honest poll done, you'd probably find the Iranian public is probably the most pro-American of almost any in the region.
You might find the same poll of Americans regarding Iran, yet we hear from the Iranians, death to America, and we hear from American leaders, oh, the hostages, oh, the death right. of soldiers in Beirut. It's a mantra that won't stop. What's going to break it?
Well, I think as long as you have the Islamic Republic led by the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guard, whose ideology requires a hostility towards us to justify the kind of internal repression, you're going to find it difficult to change that. The question is whether an ideology that really isn't bought by the public, whether that changes Iran over time. A lot of times, many times I've sort of equated what we see in Iran to what we saw in the Soviet Union in 1980, where you had an ideology that the public didn't accept and much of the elite didn't accept. Those who were in power used it. Sooner or later, there's a corrosive reality where if no one really believes the ideology, it eats away at it and it's hard to sustain it. So my own view is, over time, we're likely to see this wear away. But between now and that point, a lot of destructive things can happen.
Ambassador Dennis Ross served as President Obama's special assistant on Iran from 2009 to 2011 and as President Clinton's chief U.S. negotiator for Arab-Israeli issues from 1993 to 2001. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It may be the case that all health is local. Certainly your own personal health is the most local of all. A community's culture, habits, and practices all contribute to health, and you can go to thetakeaway.org to see how your zip code is doing health-wise. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's County Health Rankings Report gives you a way of comparing your own community with others. We've also found this week in our health series, Zip Code Decode, how where you live matters to your health, that individual communities may be neglecting health even as they share collective spiritual values. In Paris, Tennessee, in Henry County, designated as an evangelical hub by the American Communities Project, spiritual health is a priority at the expense of physical health and high rates of inactivity. Chad Lampe of WKMS says that while spiritual values have contributed to the health neglect in Paris, Tennessee, the active churches are the key to making a turnaround.
Once a year, the small town of Paris, Tennessee claims to host the world's biggest fish fry, where thousands enjoy hand-battered, deep-fried catfish and hush puppies. The town's also home to a scaled-down replica of the Eiffel Tower. But most importantly, at least to this story anyway, Paris and Henry County are home to more than 160 churches. That's about one church for every 195 people. Each Sunday, about 12 miles east of Paris's catfish-inspired welcome sign, you'll find around 200 to 300 people in a worship service at Sulphur Well Church of Christ on the outskirts of the county. The church is hard to find.
We have a guy who comes and speaks here periodically, and he likes to say, "I've been to a lot of towns without churches. This is the only church I've been to without a town."
That's 31-year-old lead pastor Bob Palmer. He's smart and honest, especially when it comes to his thoughts on the church's role in spiritual and physical health. Palmer says the data from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and American Communities Project should be an eye-opener. In Palmer's county alone, the rate of physical inactivity is high, nearly double the inactivity rates of some of the healthiest states.
One of the things that was striking about these numbers is something I've known to be true, which is Protestant churches and Church of Christ falls in this category of just, there's a sense to where when we confirm someone's spiritual health and give them a thumbs up and an A-OK, that's often the end of the rehabilitation process, right?
But Palmer says it's not that the church isn't focused on physical health or the body's temple. In fact, he says there is some irony.
And here's where I'll pick on us. We do draw some hard lines on alcohol and tobacco use and tattoos. And we think, oh, you're not taking care of the temple that God has given you. The problem is that we have not looked at it holistically, right? We've just kind of picked out the things that we weren't going to do anyway. And so we feel self-righteous about that we don't do them. And I'll take a number five, supersize it.
Palmer believes that this type of hypocrisy within the church and generally poor health statistics could also be a deterrent for someone looking to join a church and may be part of a decline in church membership and attendance overall.
Maybe that's an indictment on what we've been teaching. And I'll say this, if I were an outsider to faith and the church in any context, and all I had were these numbers to go on, it would not be attractive to me at all. And if anything, it would make me kind of run the opposite direction of, wow, your quality of life is really poor statistically.
In Tennessee, the Governor's Foundation for Health and Wellness might have some remedies for boosting poor health through a new program connected to an initiative called Healthier Tennessee. The Governor's initiative targets whole towns and communities along with smaller, more cohesive groups like businesses and churches.
Small Starts for Worship launched in October of last year, October of 2014.
That's Communication Director Molly Sudderth.
It's a wellness program, an online wellness tool that provides the faith leaders with tips, ideas, and actions to get their members healthier.
Currently, the Small Starts program is underway in about 150 churches statewide, but none of those are in Henry County yet. Sudderth says the program is new, and she expects the number of participating churches to grow with the help of local extension agents spreading the word. Public health educator Barbara Kelly has explored the program and sees promise for getting church members moving and eating healthier foods.
One of the apps, I was looking through the worship site. One of them is, walk and worship. So, you walk and pray for those you feel, need extra prayers or going through difficulties or maybe just need some lifting up. So there's a lot of things that maybe we just haven't thought of that before. Well, of course we could do that. And yes, that's a good idea.
The program may appear like a good idea, but there's still stigma tied to healthy living within this largely conservative area. Pastor Bob Palmer uses the word stewardship for care of the human body and the environment.
Right-winged religious folks have kind of viewed that as liberal thinking, but that hasn't been correct, I don't think, at all. You just read through early Genesis, and the very first commission God gives anyone is to essentially take care of this created world. And we don't talk about that very often for some reason, to our detriment, and some of these numbers reflect that.
Palmer knows he might be a bit of an outlier in his view regarding a holistic approach to health among evangelicals, but he hopes others will follow, not only for the sake of community health, but to maintain his flock. For The Takeaway, I'm Chad Lampe.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Huckenberry. Here's a quick appeal. The more subscribers we have, the easier it is for us to attract the sponsors to keep our show going. So if you like the program, please let folks know. A Facebook like or a follow on Twitter means so much. Thanks again for downloading this podcast, which is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International.
Support for The Takeaway comes from PBS and Masterpiece, presenting Wolf Hall, a tale of ruthless ambition and political intrigue set in the court of Henry VIII, starring Mark Rylance and Damian Lewis, premiering Sunday at 10, 9 central on PBS. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Since we have been examining zip codes and health, it turns out that some folks who work in virtually every zip code, sometimes two dozen zip codes in a single day, may have some of the worst health problems in America. The traveling community of long-haul truck drivers in this country have some of the worst rates of obesity, heart disease, and life expectancy of any occupation group. Former trucker Sipiwe Baleka has taken it on as his mission to become a personal trainer to an occupation that sits way too much and exercises way too little.
Truck drivers have a unique occupation. They live in a box. They don't have access to a kitchen. They're not able to get to the local organic farmers market. And their schedules are unique. Sometimes they're driving at night. Sometimes they're driving in the day. Sometimes they're not driving at all. If you ask the average person, why are truck drivers overweight or obese to begin with? The average person is going to say, oh, it's because they eat too much and they're lazy. But that's not true. The vast majority of drivers, they're only eating once or twice a day. They're actually undernourished. So the real root of the problem is their metabolisms are very low and they're not producing hormones properly.
How long did it take for you to understand that being a trucker had a really serious impact on your body and your health?
2 months. I gained 10.7% of my body weight in the first 2 months of my career, and that was sort of my wake-up moment.
And what did you do to reverse that besides getting out of trucking? And a lot of truckers, of course, don't have the option of getting out of trucking.
Well, I tested everything. I started out by doing push-ups and sit-ups kind of haphazardly. I tried every kind of fitness equipment from perfect push-up stands to medicine balls and kettlebells and dumbbells and resistance bands and ankle weights and every kind of diet, Weight Watchers, Atkins, Mediterranean, Paleo, all of those things I tried to find out what worked and what didn't work. And that's when I realized there's a fitness and nutrition program out there for everyone in America, except one that was specifically designed for long-haul truck drivers, their unique environment, and their unique schedules. I mean, this is an epidemic we're talking about. One out of three Americans is obese. Two out of three truck drivers is obese, okay? So the health of truck drivers is public policy for America because, one, they have to take a physical every 2 years just to qualify for their job. And two, everything that you can touch, everything that you have in your house and in your office has come off of a truck. Without truck drivers, this economy comes to a halt.
What's your stake in all this? I mean, what do you get out of all this? And please don't tell me you've got some, like, you know, build up your abs device that I can have for $19.95.
I mean, I was a truck driver, and I saw what it did to me, and then I learned how to undo the damage and stay healthy and stay fit on the road, and I realized there was a real need for this system for truck drivers. I mean, that's sort of my mission. That's my passion is when you help people transform their lives and they lose 20 or 30 pounds and they start coming off of medications or they no longer need a CPAP, you've really helped someone. That's a good thing. So I feel like that's my mission is to do the best I can to make the world a better place. And I have this unique skill set where I know a lot about physiology and metabolic endocrinology, but I also know truck drivers.
And what's the first thing I do if I'm driving a Kenworth and I pull into some parking lot and there you are waiting for me?
First thing you do is log your food for 7 days, everything you eat and drink so that you can see what your nutritional profile is. For a lot of these drivers, what I'm teaching them, it has very little to do with calories. It has to do more with how do you spike or turn your metabolism up to engage your fat burning system so that you can burn fat while you are actually behind the driver's wheel. So for drivers, we show them how to do a 4-minute workout right on the side of their truck at maximum intensity based on their own fitness level that will do just that, turn their metabolism up to its highest level. And then we show them how to eat and what to eat every 3 hours to maintain that high metabolic level. And once you learn that, it's very easy to lose weight in the truck.
And does a higher metabolism mean more alert drivers, more safe driving in periods when, you know, sleep can be a problem?
I believe it does directly, and there's plenty of statistics that suggest this. There is a well-established link between sleep apnea and driver fatigue and highway accidents. If you have sleep apnea or some disordered breathing issue when you're sleeping that's related to obesity, you are 7 times more likely to be involved in an accident. And obese truck drivers cause 45% more accidents per mile driven than normal weight truck drivers. So the statistics definitely show a link there. But more importantly, you know, the government and the Department of Transportation has statistics that show that prescription medication, over-the-counter medication, illness, and driver fatigue were a factor in 33% of highway accidents between, I think it was 2001 and 2003.
Well, the very enthusiastic mission of Sipiwe Baleka, former truck driver, triathlete, and a fitness instructor who designs health regimens for truck drivers to lose weight and stay healthy and to stop being one of the unhealthiest employment classifications in America. Sipiwe, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari, to Hatchapi to Tonopah, driven every kind of rig that's ever been made. Driven the back road so I wouldn't get way.
Truck drivers can get healthy, then what are you doing to be more active during your day? Julia from Gainesville, Florida. To be less sedentary, I've chosen not to have cable or TV at home, and I canceled my internet service about a year ago. I was spending too much time on my computer at home after working at a desk all day. I had withdrawals for a while, but now I'm doing all the projects that have been waiting for me for years. My house is cleaner and my garden is happier. Nothing about your health there, Julia. Peggy from Oklahoma City. I have a step counter app on my Samsung Galaxy cell phone. This encourages me to take more steps during the day. My daily goal, 10,000 steps.
This is Sharon Green from Wareham, Mass. And while I'm sitting all day, I do butt crunches.
This is Rebecca. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. When my family left New York City for Charlotte, we dreaded the car-bound lifestyle. We found a neighborhood we could afford where we can walk to one park, one grocery store, one restaurant, and one elementary school. And despite the school not being 100% what we wish it would be, we relish the ability to walk.
Share your tips and tricks with us and keep stepping. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, or tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo, offering a variety of business cards and printed products. Moo also offers Printfinity, the ability to print a different image on every card. More at Moo.com. Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
We're going to end this hour with a much deeper exploration of the much vaunted misunderstanding behind the rather unpleasant PR debacles, boycotts, and condemnations unfolding now in Indiana and Arkansas. The Religious Freedom Restoration Acts in both states seem to give business owners some opt-out provision of anti-discrimination laws if they would have to violate some deeply held religious belief, a spiritual belief that the Supreme Court has held that people cannot be compelled to violate by the state under the famous Hobby Lobby case from last year. Ellie Mistal is an editor at the journal Above the Law. He says Hobby Lobby was actually an invitation for politicians to create just this kind of controversy.
I'm really surprised that people are so angry in Indiana, because the Supreme Court did all of their discriminatory work for them last year during the Hobby Lobby decision. The key to that decision, Justice Alito expanded the meaning of persons, which previously had meant actual people or nonprofit corporations, and they expanded that meaning to for-profit corporations. So under Hobby Lobby, any corporation can claim a religious exemption to discrimination laws, basically, based on Alito's reasoning. Now, this is an important distinction. If you think about it, nobody really has a problem if the Catholic Church says, I'm not going to give you bread because you are gay. That's not great. That's not something that I would support, but it's the Catholic Church. You're going to let them do what they do. If the soup Nazi says, no soup for you because you're gay, that's a completely different level of discrimination, and that's the level of discrimination that Hobby Lobby opened up.
But how is it the same that someone who, say, sells flowers in Indiana, who isn't paying anything, is actually getting money to serve a client who is involved in a same-sex marriage ceremony? How is that the same? How does that become an equivalent sort of restriction of religion?
The best way of putting it is that before the Indiana law, before Hobby Lobby, before all of this went down, if I wanted something, if I was gay and I wanted something and you denied me that service, that thing that is open to the rest of the public because I was gay, then I have a discrimination suit against you. And the lawsuit then becomes, did you or did you not discriminate against me because I was gay? Maybe you discriminated against me because you don't like me. That's fine, actually. If you discriminate against me because of my class status, then you lose that lawsuit. In Indiana now, under the RFRA, the alleged discriminator has a defense to say that, yes, I discriminated against you, but I discriminated against you because I have a deeply held religious belief. And my deeply held religious belief allows me to supersede your rights as a person to discriminate against you in this particular way.
But wait, it's more like, because I don't like the gay marriage thing, I can discriminate against you. If I just don't like gays, that's against the law.
That might be a distinction without a difference, honestly. We don't know how these court cases are gonna actually turn. We don't know how these lawsuits are actually gonna come out. One of the weird things about the Indiana law, right, is that they don't actually require you to explain where you've got this deeply held religious belief. Arguably anybody could say it. There's a pizza place in Indiana that says, well, we're not gonna deliver pizzas to gay weddings, as if there's a gay wedding that has pizza delivery. But anyway.
I'm not going there, but whatever.
You know, they could claim arguably anything. And then the way that the law is set up now is that the courts would have to figure out if there was a less discriminatory way for protecting the owner's religious beliefs, right? But that completely shifts the burden of the question from a binary, did you or did you not discriminate against this person, to a much more nebulous, well, yes, you discriminated, but what's your belief? And how deeply held is that belief? And what other ways might you have been able to? It becomes an entire morass of problems. And that's why a lot of the critics have been saying about the Indiana law, the problem is that it opens up the state. It opens up the situation to all kinds of discrimination that we don't know where it's going to come from yet, and we don't know how the courts are going to sort that out.
All right, here's one for you. It is illegal, if I own a retail establishment, to put a sign in my window that says, we do not serve blacks here, correct?
Correct.
Is it illegal for me to put a sign in my window which says, we do not serve individuals who are planning to have same-sex marriages?
I mean, it's really – it's almost a Minority Report pre-COG level.
It's a stumper all of a sudden,
can you
right?
ban somebody for something that they might do? That's unclear. There are legitimate distinctions between, let's say, a public accommodations place. That was the main of the segregation of the civil rights laws, right? So there's a distinction between something that's a public accommodation versus businesses that seem more like speech, right? So if I have a restaurant and I say I'm not going to serve gay people – that's probably still illegal, although in Indiana there will be a court case now probably over that. If I say I'm not going to bake a cake for gay weddings, that's a little bit different because now you're not just dealing with discrimination laws. You're dealing with kind of more seemingly legitimate First Amendment laws because baking the cake requires a creative expression.
If I very compellingly – and I can't do this because I don't believe this – but if I was able to say to you – I love America. I believe in America. I have lots of friends who are gay, but I just – the idea of a marriage between two people who are the same sex just offends me. It just really – I just can't do that religiously. Do I have standing to say that in America and to act on that belief if I can convince you that I am truly offended as opposed to somebody just playing a little legal game?
Sure. And I would say that if you feel that way, you absolutely have a right to not get gay married. If you really don't like gay marriage, if it's not good for you, if you think that it's wrong, if you think that it's immoral, you should by all means not get gay married. That's your right.
And if I said to you, I can't sleep at night because I sold these lilies to this couple who got married in this way that it just really offends me.
I can't sleep.
Would you say to that?
I would say I can't sleep at night because the Mets signed Michael Kadire as their big free agent signing, right? Like, there are lots of things that make us not be able to sleep. I can go to Shea Stadium, and I can boo, all right, but I can't make it legally impossible for Michael Kadire to play.
They come to my shop to buy flowers.
You're selling the flowers.
But Justice Alito.
Justice Alito suggests, Indiana suggests, that you selling them flowers would be an unimaginable impingement on your religious belief. How far are we willing to take that? Because there are lots of things in the Bible. There are lots of things in the Torah. There are lots of things in the Quran that suggest that you should be really angry about that we're not anymore. There are so many anachronistic prohibitions in these ancient texts that the thought of applying those prohibitions under the guise of legal protection so that you can deny somebody else services, it would be an unworkable society if we did that. Mm.
Ellie Mistal, an editor at Above the Law, editor-at-large of Breaking Media, which publishes Above the Law, and is the managing editor of ATL Redline. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
And here's one thing to take with you before we go. Behold the Cliffs of Hathor. Yes, the Cliffs of Hathor, named for the Egyptian star goddess, exist. You can see them courtesy of the camera on the European Rosetta probe, which has swooped within 8.6 miles of Comet 67P's surface. There's a link at thetakeaway.org. The Cliffs of Hathor could use their own epic fantasy trilogy, I think. Make the Takeaway your personal mobile comet. Subscribe to our podcast. It's a great way to stay up on the news. And you can find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.